think the best advice that I've ever gotten as a writer, I probably ignored because basically of prejudice, because I heard at some point, yes, there are people who plan everything. And there are people who, you know, pantser versus plotter, people who kind of take it more as it comes. And I thought, well, that second group of people, they're just undisciplined. Clearly, I'm not going to write like that. And I just kept trying to plan more. Clearly, I was failing because my planning wasn't good enough. If I planned harder, that's just all I need to do. And I thank God that I finally just decided to start writing something without doing anything more than vague planning. I do have a plan to get to the end of a book, but I absolutely never write that down. Because if I write it down, I feel restricted by it.
This is the Crit RPG Podcast, your one-stop shop for everything Lit RPG, Progression Fantasy, and Royal Road.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the Crit RPG Podcast, the only podcast offering you extremely circumstantial parental advice. With me today is Erin Ampersand, author of Apocalypse Parenting. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. It's good to be here.
Yes. We've already we've been talking for 45 minutes. So
Yeah. But there's no screaming from downstairs, so we're good for now.
Yet. If you wanna listen to that, you can hop on Patreon and check it out if you want. But otherwise, we're going to be hopping into the main podcast now. And we've been dancing around this topic. I mean, we've talked about school system, we've talked about system apocalypses in general, we've talked about growing up and kids and the mental ability and faculties of kids. So that was kind of fun. But what we haven't talked about in depth yet is your book, Apocalypse Parenting, which is not a guide.
Not explicitly, but I do feel like some people have gotten, some people have said that they've been inspired by my protagonist, and I'm pretty honored by that. There's a lot of things that happen in the book too that, obviously, how do you teach your kid to fight monsters is not necessarily universally applicable, but and how do you keep two kids that could easily kill each other from killing each other? Maybe not universally applicable, but that more so you're going to have things that kind of carry over, because it would take a lot of effort for my actual children to kill each other. But if they really put their mind to it, they could. And they could definitely hurt each other. So the parenting tactics that you'd use in an apocalypse aren't necessarily completely separate from the parenting tactics you'd use in normal life. So
just as always, I know it's probably not a part of your system, but just skip the suppression colors.
No.
There you go. Good. All right. But tell me about how did you come to write that book and how did it come to be?
Well, so I read a lot. I've always read a lot. And when I got into Lit RPG, I discovered the post-apocalyptic genre, and I've always loved kind of apocalyptic literature. So I kind of went on a binge. I was reading a whole bunch of stuff like that. And, I was enjoying myself quite a bit, but I noticed a bunch of things that, you're reading a book, you've got your suspension of disbelief. You're like, okay, I can see why you did that. But it triggers that thing. It triggers that question in you. Yeah, I don't know if I completely believe that, but moving on. And in this sort of sense, there were a couple things. One book I read had kids basically rescued from the apocalypse and put someplace else so that people didn't have to think about them. Several other books were children don't get superpowers. You can't get superpowers until you're, 12, 13, 14. And I'm like, well, that's convenient. Because it just completely dodges the whole question of how do you deal with a 9-year-old that can shoot fireballs? How do you deal with a toddler that's as strong as an adult? And I was like, yeah, I guess I can see why the authors wouldn't want to write that. That would be hard to write. And it's not really the story that they're trying to tell. Their protagonist is just, you know, off adventuring all by usually his self, occasionally herself, but usually I think, in, especially in the books that I chose to read, himself. You know, he doesn't really have a lot of like ties holding him down and stuff like that. But I wonder what it is like for the people that can't just, you know, go off and do whatever. And I wonder how, you know, you would deal if the system, this incredibly cruel system that's just tormenting humanity and, you know, doing unkind things to everybody, if it wasn't so inexplicably kind about human children, how would that go? And after a while, I was like, I had one particular idea, because I was sitting there and I was thinking about my youngest, and I was like, oh, if this kid got the ability to pick a superpower, basically, what superpower would my kids pick? And my youngest at the time had this stuffed animal that was like, they were like this. Like, I have photos of this child like in a little bounce chair with the stuffed animal, and probably like 25% of all photos ever taken of this child feature this stuffed animal. And I was like, no problems. I know what this child would do. They would make their little giraffe stuffy able to talk back to them. And I was like, haha, that would be funny. I wonder what it would do then. And so I came up with that is spoilers for the first like 10 pages. That is what the 3-year-old in my book does, turns her little turtle stuffy into an artificial intelligence. And everything else kind of came from that. And I was thinking about all of this kind of in the background of my head as I'm reading all these other books, and I more or less just started writing. And I think that was very fortunate, because this is far from the first book that I've tried to write, but I have always done a lot of planning that I thought I needed to do, because a lot of people told me all of these ways to plan your story and ways to better plan your story and all of this. And I always 20 to 50,000 words in hated what I'd written, just absolutely hated it, completely despised it. I felt like the characters weren't true to themselves. I felt like I was too tied up in the future to write the present of the book. No good. But with this story, I didn't have such expectations for myself. I just kind of started writing, and apparently that's just a whole lot better for me as an author. And people really responded to it. Cause I was just posting serially on Royal Road, and people were like, oh my God, a middle-aged woman protagonist. That's insane. Middle-aged
women. Zero puff stars.
What?
Zero puff stars. No. Instantly.
Middle-aged women don't exist. And I'm like, yeah, actually, now that you pointed out, that's kind of true. Like, what? After a woman's like, you know, 30, like, she gets to be there as like maybe like a side character, maybe she like gives a few words of wisdom or something, but you don't really have a lot of middle-aged women protagonists in just about anything, certainly adventure stories. And you don't have a lot of parent protagonists in adventure stories either. We sort of say, you know, if you are a parent, you basically don't exist for this whole genre that everybody loves. Maybe if your kids get kidnapped, you can go rescue them. But as soon as you're back with your kids, that's it. You're no longer interesting. You no longer have a story. We don't want to follow you. And I mean, certainly it does take a strange set of circumstances before a parent will do dangerous things in the company of their child. But that's what I did. I made a strange set of circumstances. Like, that's the great thing about self-publishing and speculative fiction in general. Like, You want to write something? No problem. You just set it up. You write it. You put it on the internet. And other people can just read it. No publishers. You know, if I took this to a publisher, they probably would have been like, there's no market for this. There's yeah. There's no evidence that anybody... You need to just write these things that we know will be successful. And you're not doing that, so sorry, goodbye. But self-publishing, whatever. You know, What kind of books have been popular in our genre? Like, Beware of Chicken? A story about a fighting chicken on a farm? Well, it's not just about the chicken, but like...
It's mostly about a guy dodging the hero's journey. Like, that's the main thing.
But the chicken is the title character. And, yes, yes. You know, there's certainly a whole bunch of, like, fighting farm animals. I
absolutely.
There's a book about an isekai Roomba. There's a book yes. where a man is transmigrated into the body of a female ant. Like,
yes.
And we're good with this. We're all good with this. But then, you know, it's kind of funny to me because a lot of people, you know, they're like, yeah, I'll read this. I'll read this isekai Roomba. I'll read this, you know, guy transmigrated into the body of a female ant. But then even in our genre, a lot of people are like, apocalypse parenting. Yeah, I'm not a parent. But you are an ant? A female ant?
Yes. Yes.
But I guess
I'm just 10,000 horns in a trench coat.
I feel like you know, I've got a lot of good reviews. I've done something good here. I at this point, three books in, I'm actually pretty proud of myself. You know, I came in as a semi-finalist in this year's self-published science fiction contest, which had there were over 200 entrants from around the globe. And this wasn't a lit RPG contest. This was like all science fiction. There were a few other people. Mm-hmm. There were like, I think, four or five other lit RPG authors that entered. But like, I was competing against a lot of like serious sci-fi, like real sci-fi. And like the judges looking at my weird, silly book next to this serious sci-fi said, you know what? This is real good. And I can't tell you how proud that makes me feel.
That's pretty good.
But yeah, like, I mean, seriously, like maybe you're not a parent, but like you've had parents. You may wish to understand other people who are parents better. Give like, this is my shout out to you and your listeners. Like, give it a try. I think you might be surprised. I've had a lot of people who aren't parents say that they really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, like,
you have parents.
Yes. I mean, do I? Who knows? I have like a whole tragic backstory. No, I'm kidding. Now, people on Facebook have been universally very positive about it, right? So they've always, like, many people, like, you mentioned, or we talked about the cover a little bit, right? Because it's kind of hard to make a cover that really encapsulates your novel.
It's right? terrible. Like, I get people who are like, yes, I love this. And, you know, so one of the judges in the self-published science fiction contest, he's like, this is amazing. This cover is such a perfect promise for the book. But like, on the other hand, like it is, I mean, it's here behind me. Like it is kind of, it's telling you a lot of different things. We've got the angry sort of harsh font of apocalypse. We've got the silly kind of blocky font of parenting. We've got the monster's foreleg in the background. We've got the protagonist with her ramshackle weapons and her, you know, galoshes and stuff like that. Like, there's a lot going on there. And I can understand why some people are pushed away. But I will say, it is a hard series to make a cover for because we don't see a lot of parents in adventure media. And to make a book that is about a parent, everybody looks at it and assumes it's for kids.
Yep.
If you do anything that relates to children in any way, our mental trigger is this is for kids. And trying to do something that fights, that isn't that, that fights against that, like, I don't have a roadmap here.
So you're saying it's very hard to make that apparent?
Yes.
The puns will not stop. The puns will not stop until morale improves.
I'm here for it. I enjoy puns. I try to restrain myself while writing, but I enjoy a good pun. And a bad, I enjoy bad puns too. I just enjoy puns.
Bad puns is an oxymoron. It's like I don't know, like dry water or good morning. Right. No, like, man, we talked about, it was a lot. It was really a lot. Like, I've done some notes here. I think, like, the first thing I kind of want to talk about is that I think many lit RPG authors and, like, System Apocalypse authors, or I should say Isekai Apocalypse authors, I think they're mostly just scared about, you know, writing kids dying, right? That's like, because that's really oof. And a lot of our readers, they kind of want to have a sort of escapism, right? And so if you pick up a book and there's kids in there, right? You need to make really sure that there's either going to be a promise, okay, kids are never going to die in this, or that you kind of get it over with quickly, I guess. I don't know.
So
I have no solution.
I know it's definitely a delicate dance that I have to do, because I don't want to write a squishy, fluffy series where you don't ever worry about anybody. You know, nothing bad ever happens to anybody, because you can't. It's very difficult to believe in that. It's very difficult to buy into that. But I'm also a parent, and I don't want to sit here watching kids die either. So, like, I don't want to, like, give anybody any spoilers or any promises, but, like, I will say that I am a parent, and I guess I will say things are probably going to work out well for the protagonist's children in the end. They're everyone else, they will pay some costs, but they will probably be okay in the end.
I just think, like, I mean, if we're looking at the system apocalypses that are out there with, you know, as you said, like the very sadistic kind of system and everything like this, I think the first thought that for some people might be there is going to be like, okay, at some point the main character is going to have to, like, murder a child, right? And that's like, yeah, that's hard to sell people on.
No,
so, I know it's not in your book, but I'm saying, like,
no, I totally understand that. What I don't want to give away too much detail, but what I think I can say that won't spoiler things too much is that, you know, I mentioned before the comparison to Dungeon Crawler Carl, and how you mentioned in there, like, the aliens in charge more or less forced contestants to kill other contestants. The aliens in charge of the system's descent onto Earth in my series are not the only group of aliens out there, and they do not have unlimited power. So humans are not explicitly required to kill and betray other humans. They are heavily encouraged to, but explicitly required? No.
And I think that we were talking about this before we began, or even just a couple of minutes ago, that, like, the entire idea of, like, why I don't like reading System Apocalypses is the reason why you like it, or the flip side of it, right? So I said, like, hey, I don't really want to see people being ugly to each other. It's not something I enjoy. It makes me anxious. I will write it, but I won't read it. But I will let you guess how that works. Not well. You said that you actually like the idea of, like, people banding together and overcoming odds.
Yeah, I like people having the choice to be ugly to each other. People maybe even having the incentive or encouragement to be ugly to each other. Mm-hmm. But making the choice, in maybe sometimes even against all odds, taking a risk to not be ugly to each other. I like the community. I believe in humanity. I really do. You know, I believe a lot of things about humanity. I mean, I think COVID showed us that we certainly have a bunch of people who will not do the slightest thing to protect or care for the people around them. But, you know, the opposite is true as well. Like, COVID has also shown us that a bunch of people will go out of their way, will really work hard to protect everyone around us, around them as much as possible. And so there are people in my books, you know, it's not like everybody just, oh my gosh, the aliens are here, kumbaya, we've all come together, we're all a team, yay! But, I mean, let's be real here. If you've got two sets of people, one of whom is, you know, just out for themselves, right? And another group who wants everybody to succeed. The self-interested group can easily have a lot of short-term success, but they're going to have trouble as things get bigger, building alliances and stuff like that. And the more, let's say the less sociopathic group is going to...
altruistic?
The more altruistic group is easily going to find allies and friends. And so I think it's almost inevitable that in the end, the most powerful groups are going to be the ones that care for people.
All right. So after you switched your headset on, because we had some sound issues, let's jump to the next question. And if we interrupted something very, very important and you're going to be in the podcast going like, wait, weren't they going to be talking about this very, very exciting thing that I'm very, very sorry that we both forgot?
We did.
We both did, yeah. Anyway, moving on. So what's the best advice you've ever gotten as a writer?
So I thought, because you gave me a list of things that you were planning to ask, and I was thinking about this, and honestly, I think the best advice that I've ever gotten as a writer, I probably ignored, to be honest, because basically of prejudice, because I, you know, heard at some point, yes, there are people who plan everything, and there are people who, you know, pantser versus plotter, people who kind of take it more as it comes. And I thought, well, that second group of people, they're just, you know, undisciplined and stuff like that. So, you know, sure, some people write like that, but clearly I'm not going to write like that. And so I just ignored the fact that these people existed for decades, and I just kept trying to plan more. Clearly I was failing because my planning wasn't good enough. If I planned harder, that's just all I need to do. So I write, you know, and there's lots of books out there telling you how to plan your writing. There's lots of, you know, advice from people telling you how to plan your writing. I had in English, I was dual major in college, and so I got a lot of advice from professors telling you how to plan your writing. And they mentioned, you know, that some people are more not like that. And I was just like, yeah, whatever, but not me. And I thank God that I finally just decided to start writing something without doing anything more than vague planning, because otherwise I don't know. I think maybe I would have eventually figured out that I was my own problem, but it had been a few decades and I hadn't figured it out yet. So it doesn't look good for me in that respect. But yeah, I do have a plan to get to the end of a book, I have a plan to get to the end of the series, but I absolutely never write that down, because if I write it down, I feel restricted by it. And if I feel restricted by it, I don't change it. And when I was writing before, you know, I'd be writing the opening pages of a book, and I'd be thinking about the end of the book. I'd be thinking about chapter 30 of the book and not focused on what I was writing right then. And I'd be thinking, you know, oh, my main character has to show these qualities so that they can do this later.
Oh, and formulate it, yeah.
And everybody just ended up feeling so artificial, so cardboard, so stilted. And like when I transitioned from one thing to another, again, it just felt like it felt so arbitrary. And I think that there are authors who do plan, who can avoid those things, but I do think that they are weaknesses. There's weaknesses to both writing styles. I want to be clear about that. The weakness of pantsing, or just flying by the seat of your pants, is you can easily, like, you have to be very aggressive about just tossing out huge sections of what you wrote because you flew in the wrong direction. And it can be easy to sort of lose the thread of the plot if you're not careful. The weaknesses of planning, there's weaknesses there too, which is that I think it's easier for authors to sort of just have things happen and not completely make sense, because they had already decided this is what was going to happen. You know, if you ever have a character do something in a book that really seems out of character for them, I think it's a good indication that the author was a plotter and had decided a long time ago that this character was going to do this and didn't re-examine. That's not
Or they were a pantser and completely rolled in the wrong direction, and then were like, oh wait, shit, I wanted to go there. And then we're like, oh, shiny. And they like jump back onto the main thing.
It's possible. And as I said, I'm not saying that either writing style is inherently better. The only reason that I'm offering criticisms at all is because I'm hoping, you know, if there's a listener out there like me, who's just smashing their face into a wall over and over because they're like, this one is inherently better. And this other one clearly has weaknesses. There are weaknesses to both approaches. That's all I'm trying to say.
And oh, absolutely.
For me, the weaknesses of plotting were more crippling. And I didn't realize it. I just kept dragging myself forward with my busted leg. Like, this is going to work.
Rigid pants. I don't know. Like, this morning I thought about this because the first couple of books I wrote, I also plotted heavily. And then I was like, oh no, this is not for me. And I actually got in, like, I actually lost all love of writing because of it. Because I started the book and I wrote it, and then it was like, these characters make no sense. Like, this is just like plot stuff happening. And then I started writing Torchbearer. And I just didn't care about anything. I just went wherever I wanted to, and it felt great. Felt awesome. And then I finished the book, and I was like, "This sucks. This is terrible." Like the characters like are just going on about the emotions like five times. Like it's like I had eight times. I wrote the same like emotional spiral eight times in the first version, and I was like, "I'm never gonna do this again." And then I talked to Travis Baldry, who was like, "I hate doing things twice. I want to put to pants, but no, I just plot." I'm like, that actually sounds like very reasonable advice, even though it's not advice. So what I do now is like it's not really a mixture. I wouldn't even call it a mixture. I have plotted my entire book out, but I think I have the very, very firm belief that you cannot know how to plot a book until you've finished one. Because the moment you finish a book or a series or whatever, then you know where your weaknesses are, where your problems are, and where your strengths are. And I think before that, both things, like if you plot too much and you never get going, that's bad. But also if you plot too much and then come to the end and like the characters feel like Hollywood cardboard cutouts, yeah, that's terrible. So you need to know like how to alleviate that next time, right? But same thing for like pantsing. If you pants so much and like you driving into like weird corners, and then you need to know, okay, maybe I need to plot that. So what I do right now is I have like a really, really huge like outline that is kind of close, but not really. So I have like everything that needs to happen like in the 8 beats. I have 13 beats that need to happen. I don't have anything planned out as far as like when does she get new powers, but I do have her like emotional journey planned because I don't want to get stuck in the emotional stuff again. Now, the next point is I kind of, at each of these plot points, I guess, whenever I get to them, I blow them up, like I expand them. So I write like a couple of paragraphs, what then needs to happen, and then I need to take each paragraph and turn each paragraph into a chapter. And I've actually even started to like write down what needs to happen in each paragraph while I'm doing it. So before I start writing, I go like, oh, actually, like in this chapter, she needs to decide this, then do that, and do this, and do that, and do this. Because I'm close enough to know how she feels, right? Yeah. And then I just write that. And this actually works pretty well for me because I'm both close enough to know how she feels and what the previous emotions were, that I also kind of can think about how she, like, how she would act. And the last part, if I am plotting and know who the characters are, because I've written them before and mm-hmm. I've written a lot about them before, then I can really plot, because then my characters aren't wooden. So I write the characters first and I pants the characters. Then I take what I've taken out of that and put that in a plotting outline, and then I pants between, like, it's a really weird mix of everything, but it works really well for me.
I think everybody everybody who's successful anyway is probably some kind of mix. Like, it's not fair to say that I don't plot at all, because I do a lot with plot, and I always have a goal, and I always have at least a path that I could take to that. Just I have a weird hang up where if I write it down, I feel limited by that. So the plotting and the planning is all purely up here at this point.
That's good. I mean, like, obviously it kind of works, right? You're like at 400 ratings on Amazon?
Around there, yeah. But maybe, I mean,
that's good.
Yeah, I think everybody's just got to find a way that works for them. And it's, I mean, I think people can share advice and find, it's not like each, yeah, you can definitely like, there's going to be commonalities, but I think that everybody is going to have their own process to some degree.
I think it was Ravensdegger, either Ravensdegger or Shirt, who said that advice isn't there to tell you what not to do. It's there to warn you of things that are hard to do.
I could see that.
I don't know how he pointed it out, but it was actually really, really good advice. It's in the roundtable discussion that we had, I think, end of May. So if you want to, you can listen to that. And
sure.
Yeah, actually, really, really good one. I really enjoyed that one. It was really nice. Okay. But while we're talking about the whole, you know, things we're doing differently, what is something besides the plotting that you have learned that you now do differently or would do differently the next time you... You know what time it is? That's right. It's a new ad. And this time I have two amazing stories for you to check out. First one is my friend Saving Throw, who writes a story called So When Am I a Hero? It's a system apocalypse that is quite frankly amazing. I don't like system apocalypses usually, and I devoured that one. So go and check it out. There's a link below the podcast. The second one is from another friend of mine, because I have two friends, called The Infinity Dungeon by Reject Humanity. Premise is actually pretty cool. Guy goes hiking on the Appalachian trails and stumbles into the only and first dungeon in the world, and he's the only person on Earth with a system, at least for a while. All right, go check him out. I appreciate it a lot, and I'll see you next time. You start a story.
So that is kind of a... So I mentioned the decades of failure, right? I mentioned the decades of failure. So one thing that I think has probably been bad for me in a purely like reach / financial sense is the fact that as soon as I got done writing book one, and, you know, audio companies started reaching out to me and stuff, I was like, oh, I can publish a book. I'm going to publish a book. And And I published it, and then it became a stub on Royal Road, and my audience on Royal Road stopped growing. And I think if I had just kept writing for longer and then, say, published all three books between like January of this year and now, I think I would be a lot more popular than I am. But it's hard for me to say, like, I made the wrong choice. Like, if you look at it in a vacuum, like, you're like, well, that's clearly the wrong choice. And for another author with more, like, self-confidence and stuff, I would certainly say, like, you know, if you're doing well on Royal Road, don't rush to ebook. There's really no need for that. But emotionally, you know, the satisfaction, the self-confidence that I've gotten from being a published author, I think has been a big factor in allowing me to continue to write. And at the end of the day, that's what's most important, is, you know, being able to continue to write. So while I wouldn't say that I would have done anything differently if I could go back and tell my past self with this series, because I think, you know, for internal personal reasons, it was the right choice. I will say with my next series, I'm not going to like rush to publication. I'll probably get it either completely written or close to completely written before I leave Royal Road.
Yeah. I think
sort of hamstringing myself there.
So I think many people actually, yeah, they're also rushing their release a little bit. I mean, I certainly was thinking about it, right? So, I was very lucky, actually, that the first two versions of Torchbearer were not very much to Royal Road's liking, which is good. The first one didn't really, no, like the first one didn't really take off, and the second one is like a deeply introspective, very complicated tale of like lots of layers of metaphors. People don't like that.
Multiple repetitive emotional spirals.
That's version 0.1, and then version is up right now. It's actually way better in this regard. And then I did it again, and the newest version isn't even up yet. But I'm not gonna touch it anymore. Like it's good where it is. Maybe I'll like fiddle with the first chapter, but nothing beyond that. Because like, I'll still have to like do the line edit on that one. Okay. Anyway.
I love editing. I know that makes me an extreme weirdo as an author.
Oh, I love editing too. Yeah, sure. But the thing is, like, I did it already 4 times, and now it's the fifth time, and it's 243,000 words.
That is a lot of words.
That is a lot of words, yes. So I have to like kind of like think about, I think I'm going to hire a line editor and go like, please do this for me. Thank you very much. Yeah, I was going to have to find a good one. But I was very lucky in that like it didn't really take off, because I know I'm not going to like make millions with this book. It's a good, like, I like this book, and there's people who like this book, and I'm okay with that. I always like to quote this one person who gave me a review that said, like, the author's podcast great, his book convoluted, which is like, ooh, ouch, brother.
That's rough,
yeah. But like, I think he has a point. Like, they all had a point. Like, the version that they read is still kind of convoluted. It is hard to get into, because the main character is very unlikable at the start. And so it's not going to get any easier to read. Like, it's not going to get like any less complicated. And I don't even like know my rating anymore. I checked it once, and then I was like, ah, okay, this is not very good. I don't want it anymore. Like, it was like below 4 or something.
I think the reason that I was checking out your stuff, and I checked out Torchbearer a little bit, but I really enjoyed the band story that you had up there.
Yeah.
Which I know you're not getting back to for a bit. But
yeah, band is actually pretty fun. Like every morning in the shower, I plot band, like every morning, like, because it's such an easy story to write for me. Like, I love this thing, but I promised I would finish Torchbearer, and I'm really into Torchbearer beta right now. Like, really digging that. Like, it's really fucking fun. And the only thing I really worry about is that people don't get to the fun part where all the numbers go up. Because it's like the first book is very oof. But I think I changed enough so that people are like, okay, yeah, I can see the bare bones of like a good RPG story here. So we'll see when we interview readers.
I will when you get your next version up, I'll definitely check it out. So
cool, yeah, dope. Yeah, I'll send you something in a minute when we're done. Remind me. But yeah, like the good part is like people didn't like it, and now I have all the fucking time in the world because I got a good job that allows me to write on and off sometimes. I have the podcast. I have other stuff that I'm doing, you know, on the side. So I'm not financially depending on writing books, which is good because then I can do it as a hobby.
Yeah, it's a good place to be. I mean, I think that's kind of the dirty secret of authors is that, I mean, very few of us are financially supporting ourselves. I mean, I think I looked at it and it doesn't take that many sales to be, I think you have to sell like 12 books or something to be like in the top like 50% of authors, and you need to sell like 100 books to be in the top like 2% or something stupid like that. Just absolutely stupid. But I mean, you know, a lot of us, you know, you said you've got a solid job that gives you enough free time that you can write. You know, I am a stay-at-home parent right now, and fortunately my kids are old enough that I can occasionally get time to write. And my husband has a good enough job to allow me to be a stay-at-home parent. And I mean, that's a privilege. It's a privilege. Yes. If, you know, somebody's out there working two jobs or working one job that makes them work 70 hours a week, they're going to have a real hard time writing their masterpiece. And that's not on them.
That being said, Toni Morrison did write Beloved at 500 words each night. And Neil Gaiman wrote Coraline at 50 words each night. It's the consistency.
It's true.
But again, also like that is all the advice I can give to that point because, I mean, when I was a struggling student, I still wrote, right? I wasn't always, I mean, I'm not well off right now, right? I have to work. It's not like I've been born with a silver spoon up my ass. But the fortunate part that I really want to underscore is I like my work. I like what I do. I have fun there. And I feel appreciated and I feel like as though I'm doing something that helps other people, which is nice. Like that's all I want out of a job and of course money. Right. So the writing is in a way is a hobby and mostly a way of self-fulfillment, because I don't, you know, get to fight a lot of demons in the real world, but.
Or the demons that you fight aren't as visible to other people.
Oh. This is very good, very good quote. It is, but still, I want to say /r/ I'm 13 and this is deep.
No, I just the reason you said I don't get to fight you said I don't get to fight a lot of demons, and it's true. But I think that's also one of my favorite things about speculative fiction is taking the internal invisible things and projecting them out into something more cinematic that, you know, because, I mean, some people like literary fiction where it's just somebody fighting their personal demons for the whole book, but I don't enjoy reading that. I like when that internal conflict is more dramatic, more colorful, and I think a lot of us do.
Yes, absolutely. Like, I was just watching this Brandon Sanderson short this morning where he talks about, you know, like the Western literary fiction where it's a guy on a farm and it's just him working on a farm and like there's a storm coming, but the entire book is just him thinking about something for like 800 pages. And then he's brooding a lot and he's very stoic. And in the end, nothing changes. And that's like, you win a Pulitzer Prize with that because it's so such raw emotions. And then you're like, well, like you should read some, I don't know. Like, I mean, that's cool and all, but have you ever fought a demon king and almost lost all your friends? Because that's the same level of energy there, right? I know it's a metaphorical stuff.
No. But, yeah. I think part of the reason too is, so I mentioned that I did 2 degrees in college and one of them was English. Yeah. And I learned some things during that degree that are of use to me, but a lot of it was very frustrating. And I don't necessarily recommend the same thing to other people looking to become an author because especially in academia, there is a huge disdain for accessibility. Like, if you write something that's fun to read, like, the fact that somebody actually enjoys reading it is actually seen as a detriment to a large extent. Yeah. Like, I was in a class, it was a writing class, and they were talking about, like, all the things that authors should pursue in their books. And I, you know, raised my hand and I was like, well, and popularity, right? Because if you can't make, if you can't write a book that people want to read, all of this other stuff that you're trying to do and trying to accomplish and trying to communicate, it's not going to be very effective. And they're like, it will be effective for the people who are capable of accessing it. And I'm like, and how many of those are there exactly? Like, this is why I feel like Terry Pratchett is probably the best modern author, because you see his, you see his quotes all the time, quotes from his books, references to his books in like social threads, political threads, things like that. But like, he wrote silly books. He wrote comedy books. It's not hard to read a Terry Pratchett book. People read them because they're fun. They're funny. They make them laugh. But then sneakily, here are these lessons, these truths about the world that he's just, you know, put in there.
Same as Sanderson is putting his like mental illness in his books, right?
Yeah, no, I loved that. I loved that in Stormlight Archive. And I remember talking with a friend who was like, man, I hate reading about Kaladin. He's such a sad sack. And I'm like, no, I mean,
He's got depression.
What?
He's got depression?
Yeah, he's depressed. And like, this is a very good depiction. I've been depressed before. And like, I feel this. I feel the difficulty in, you know, just doing anything, even when it's right there for you to grab. And I and love the fact
genius.
That... Yeah, he's got a magic system that's about overcoming mental illness. Amazing!
Yeah, yeah, it's about like internalizing your own truths, right?
Yeah.
But like the here's one thing. Did you know that Brandon Sanderson is... He gets up every morning with the same amount of emotion. Like he doesn't have like these highs or lows. He doesn't wake up one morning and is like super sad or like super energetic. He has the same level of emotion the entire time. He's also incapable of feeling pain. I shit you not. Like it is true. You can look it up. He even said it himself on a podcast. And that is the genius of the man. Like he will take something that he fundamentally cannot feel himself, like, you know, crippling depression.
Okay.
And writes that.
Yeah, I would not have suspected that.
Yeah, he's
like, although it does make more sense of his ability to just like, I just write every day. Every day
I mean,
write. All right, Mr. Machine, you and Pyronaba.
I mean, like, Pyronaba's a whole different beast. like Pyronaba, I don't know them, but I have had contact with their agent and like I've seen them type on their thing. Their secret is not the speed of their typing. Their secret is that every single word just hits. They don't need to rewrite. Just goes.
I mean, yeah, like the typing speed isn't the limitation. Like to me it's the impressive thing is like when I write, I'll write, you know, if I get a really good flow, like I can write like, you know, like 1,000 words, you know, in an hour-ish. But like I can also like write a paragraph, not be sure what to do next, maybe go downstairs, make some lunch, come up, stare at the paragraph I just wrote a little bit more, change a line, walk away again, put a load of laundry in the washing machine. Like, I have to imagine that never happens to Pyronaba. Like, I haven't watched the streams because I feel like I would be personally, like, kind of... I feel like I would have my self-confidence shaken by seeing writing at that speed.
It's inspiring. It really is.
It should be. I agree. Yeah. And I'm inspired by it from a distance.
Inspired from a distance. Okay, that's cool.
Yes. Yeah, I don't think I can, like, I don't think I can like watch it from up close as I know like what's happening, but I don't think I can confront myself with that and not feel like.
Like in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, like the machine that like shows you where you are in the universe.
Yes. Total perspective board. Yes. No, that I think that would be a very, I think that's a good analogy.
I'm so glad that like sometime along like the last couple of years, I've came out of like a real big burnout when I started like writing again. Like not because I didn't get burnout because I was writing was before that. And then I started writing again. But I, at some point I just stopped comparing myself to others and just like generally happy that they can do something, which is really nice, right? Because I just, I don't know, like somehow I learned how to be happy with what I got, which is
that's
nice.
That's good. That's really, yeah, it's really good.
It still falters sometimes, but it's fun. It's great. But yeah, for ABBA or for Pirate, it's just, I'm just really like glad they can do that. And they seem like, I have another friend. I often mention him.
I love their work. I'm a huge fan.
It's like, okay, so here's the thing. I personally think, and please do not shoot me for this. I don't want to say this, but I do think that people who like The Wandering Inn would also like Torchbearer. It's got the same thing of like, you know, emotional damage, but less cute stuff. Like I have less slice of life in there.
Well,
the entire first book is basically just like one giant fight scene, but anyway, what ABBA kind of like does is like this like really cool mixture of like gruesome emotional harm inflicting that on their readers, like basically like burying them in bread, I guess, but also at the same time have like these really cool moments. I listened to Andy Parsnow narrating the next book, and I was like, after half an hour I was just done. I was like, yep, that's Pirate ABBA, all right, because Andy was like narrating her heart out. Like she was so good. Like she's the perfect narrator for this book, but she was awesome. And I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what was going to happen after. I didn't really care about the characters. I just listened and I was like, oh God, no. And that's the magic of Pirate ABBA. They can do that so well. Like, I love that. But like for me personally, it's sometimes too much. It's also the reason why I didn't finish Dungeon Crawler Carl. It's such a wonderful book. The tension is so well done. Like it is. I always joke about the fact that Dinnerman is my enemy and he doesn't even know it yet. But it's just such a fucking good book. I just can't read it because it's too intense. And Jeff Hayes told me like, hey, that's actually a compliment. I'm like, yeah, that's quite true. Like it's so good. I can't read it. But yeah.
Well, don't shoot me for this, but I will also say, I think people who would like The Wandering Inn would really like Apocalypse Parenting because Wandering Inn was one of my huge inspirations. Was one of the first lit, not it wasn't the first lit RPG I read, but it was one of them, and I definitely took a lot of inspiration from it. In trying, I have more of a system than she does, but it's definitely less like numbers heavy than most lit RPG. I wanted to keep the one of the things that I did going in is try to ask myself the question, all right, how do I make an interesting system that people can like plot and theorycraft about, but cut out absolutely every piece of fluff I can? What is the minimum that I can have so that you don't have, especially for audiobook readers, the walls of text kind of thing that you think.
Shout out to Lars Machmüller. I love you, Lars.
But also I wanted to take, I love the fact that like her world, well, their world, we don't know Pirate ABBA's gender. I have my personal feelings, but that's not necessarily accurate. Their world, you know, it feels big. There's all kinds of people doing all kinds of things. Sometimes, you know, Pirate will just take us there and like actually go into somebody's life. But even as you're walking down the characters walking down the street in a city, there's all kinds of things happening that aren't necessarily directly related to the main character. And I wanted to take some inspiration from that in terms of like at least doing like little cameos that give you glimpses into how the apocalypse is affecting everybody. Like I myself am not, I don't have a whole lot of insight into autism, but I have a lot of friends with autistic children. And so at one point there in book two, a previously nonverbal autistic child shows up who's taken mental speech. And that's a plot relevant point for a couple chapters. And basically they just didn't like physically talking, you know?
But makes it feel weird, yeah.
But they it wasn't that they didn't want to communicate. So
yeah.
I love doing little things like that where as you're going through, you know, I did not tell that boy's story, but I hope that I gave enough that you can wonder about that boy's story, that I've made him enough of a character that people who can connect to that can kind of latch onto it and think, and I like that.
That is awesome. I love that. And the reason I love that is because it's one of my weaknesses. I'm very internally focused, right? I struggle with remembering to put in details that make the world feel lived in. But I do love it if it happens. But I always adore it when people can do that and they put the intent of that in. That's nice. It's really good.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So we've been talking about like many books that we love and also enemies that we have. Dinnerman! But, yeah, there's a story behind that. I'm going to tell you after the podcast in the bonus stuff. I'm going to tell the story again.
Sounds good.
But we've never talked. Like I don't know this. I don't know Matt Dinnerman at all. Like
this is very one-sided.
It's very one. Like I'm quite sure that sometimes he sneezes and he's like Maddox. So like, I don't know. We'll see.
You hope that happens.
No, I don't. I don't like. I love this guy. Like he's great.
Okay.
Like I can't even joke about that. Like I hope you stub your toe on a Lego. we've talked about like books that we love. But what's one book that you love and why is it awesome?
Oh man. Well, we've talked about Wandering In. I absolutely love that. It's honestly like when you sent me the things, I think I responded like some of these are toughies. And that was honestly the one that like floored me the most out of all the questions because like it's very difficult. You didn't even say, tell me your favorite book. Like that question would have just shut me straight down. But like trying to like find of all the books that I've read, like, you know, even like just one to talk about, it's hard. I read a ton. I read probably over 100 books per year. And that is me having slowed down a lot since I was a child. Maybe it's only 60 these years. No, it's got to be more than that. Like I'm the kind of person who's like, oh, I'll read book one of this for this reason. Well, there's seven more. I might as well read those before I go on to something else. Like,
I wish I could still do that. I'm a very, very particular reader. And, I just don't have the time. I interviewed, I think it was, someone else who hasn't been on the podcast yet, like who hasn't been released on the podcast yet. I think it was Luke Shmilenko. And he and I, like we both talked about the fact that you just can't read because it feels like work, right? Like to me, it really does. Like it really does feel like work. So I don't know, like I'm sitting on the couch at night and this is like, I just can't, like I can't grab my Kindle. It's just, no.
Oh, that's rough.
Yeah. Yeah. So what, YouTube?
So like my favorite, I do actually have one favorite book. It's not Lit RPG at all. It's
that's okay.
The Last Unicorn by Peter S. Beagle.
Ooh, okay.
And it is my favorite book because Peter S. Beagle is some kind of wizard. Like that's my favorite book by him. But if you read anything by him, like this guy can do in a short story what some authors can't do with like 1,000 pages. And he just takes your emotions and he makes them into what he wants them to be. I don't understand. I aspire to that. If I had another author besides, you know, Pirate Abba, Terry Pratchett, Peter S. Beagle that I would mention, I am absolutely in awe of Douglas Adams' use of metaphor. Like, the ships hung in the sky in the same way that bricks don't. Like, what is that, 10 words? But, like, you've got everything there. You've got the shape of the ships. You've got the inherent wrongness of what they're doing. Like, you've got the objectionability of the whole situation. Like, you've got a perfect picture. You've got a perfect picture. And you've not only got a perfect picture of the ships, you've got a perfect picture of how the viewpoint character is feeling about the ships. Like,
yeah.
Damn.
That's so good.
And like, good. That's hardly the only like, that's the one that's leaping to mind right now. But like,
yeah.
That guy is so good with metaphors. Oh, it makes
I think. Worse. I think someone's gonna like fill their bingo card on this podcast. But whenever someone talks about like good quotes, like the entire time when you said like, "Oh, I'm struggling. I don't know what I would say." I was struggling so hard not to say like, "Have you read Cradle?"
you know, funnily enough, Cradle isn't even my favorite series by Will White. Like, I like it, but I have a soft spot for House of Blades. Like, people can say it's not as good as Cradle, and they can give very good arguments. And, like, I can't even say they're completely wrong. But I've played tons of Magic the Gathering over the years. And the fact that House of Blades was conceived Traveler's Gate. House of Blades is the first book. Traveler's Gate.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that that series was conceived as, like, somebody's attempt to, like, make a world that, like, based on the sort of the gameplay of Magic the Gathering is just so fun to me. And I think it does it so well that I've got a soft spot for it.
Have you read Slumdog Deck Builder?
I have not.
That would be something for you. And also Shami Stovall's husband, John, wrote this mob-based deck builder. I think it's called Deck Builder Enforcer or something. I would have to look it up.
I like Stovall.
John Stovall. John Stovall is her husband, and he wrote like this really interesting like mob enforcer card builder story. It's really, really interesting. And there's also one that's where it's like about like demons. I think it might be the same one, but I can really recommend those. Like, well, these are really nice.
I'll definitely check them out, and it sounds interesting. The fun thing about the Traveler's Gate series, if you haven't read it, is it's not actually a deck builder series at all. It's just built around, there are these other planes, and as you deepen your connections to these planes, then you get access to bigger and more powerful magics, which is basically, so like in Magic the Gathering, you're playing out these lands, which he represents. Which is
playing out these lands.
So, I don't know. I felt like it was a really good representation of the game without involving cards at all.
Yes.
Which I thought was really cool and clever.
So you're saying the explanation wasn't in the cards?
Yes.
Okay, good. Thanks for the explanation. I'm going to... What?
Nothing.
Good. I would have thought... Good. Well, thought. I don't know. Like, Will Write, like, something about this man always makes me want to do puns. I don't know. Like, the Cradle thing.
He claims that's his real last name. How do you get to be a lit RPG author and have your name like some kind of undead eldritch horror? I'm so suspicious of that.
Next to where I grew up, there's a village and there's a butcher's shop, and that butcher is called Stefan Lich. So Lich. So he's called Stefan Lich. And he has a butcher's shop called Stefan Lich. Like, come on.
I don't speak German. I'm sorry.
Lich, like the Lich King.
I know Lich, but what's the Stefan? Just Stephen Lich?
Stephen, yeah.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure if the first name was part of it. I'm sorry.
No, the first name is like Stefan. Yeah. Like he's.
Yeah.
Like,
it's. No, yeah. I would not name my butcher shop that. That does seem kind of suspicious. Like.
I'm pretty sure he's just hiding in plain sight, but like also in Germany, no one knows what a Lich is.
I hope that that's the case, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't know if I buy from his butcher shop, but I hope that that's the case.
They have very, very good mortadella.
Mm. I mean, I guess if their meats were good, I mean, all right.
Oh my God. There's even more evidence. It's mortadella. Holy shit. We're onto something here.
I think you are.
Yeah. I think you are. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, Will White. Yeah, that's a really cool last name. Like, unfortunately, I can't use mine, but yeah. That is a really cool last name too, but I can't use that. Anyway, thank you for sharing your book that you love and why is it awesome. But do you wanna talk about maybe shout-outs and do shout-outs?
Like shout-outs for I was kind of, I guess I should have asked questions like just shout-outs for like cool people or things that
you
I want
to. You can also shout out bad people like Matt Dinneman, for example. What?
No, so I don't even, I have to give a shout out to my husband because he's my alpha reader and my, kind of my editor, I guess. He is a wonderful man and extremely good at criticizing things, which is often frustrating, but it's amazing as an author. He's also a very, like, you know how a lot of readers, they'll be like, oh, I don't understand this, but, you know, maybe I will. No, he's like, I don't understand this. He'll tell me every time. And so it makes my writing a lot better. He'll also, like, a lot of my fight scenes, because, like, fight scenes are really hard to write. For me. For me, they're hard to write. And so if he thinks I'm dodging one that should be there, he'll call me out on it. And I go, okay, fine. It always ends up making the book better. So I have to appreciate
dodging
him.
Fight scenes. Nice.
I mean, as far as like authors and stuff, I have conversed via text. Obviously, nobody actually talks. Nobody sees Pirate Ava, but I have conversed via text with Pirate Ava, and they've been very kind. They were kind enough to give book three a shout out, so
nice.
I appreciate that. And I especially appreciate like the Lit RPG Authors Guild on Facebook because it is an amazing resource. All the people there are wonderful. I'm sure I'm forgetting people, and which is why you told me in advance, but I'm not a very bright person sometimes. So
that's okay. I mean, like everyone who knows you will feel shouted out. I'm pretty sure.
Good.
But yeah. I don't know. Like I usually also do shout outs here, but because you forgot, I'm also going to pretend to forget. So it's nice.
Oh, nice. Thanks.
Yeah.
Very cool of you.
There we go. But this has been the Crit RPG podcast with the amazing Aaron Ampersand. You and I were going to be talking about some more stuff. I wrote some stuff down here that we're still going to talk about in the Patreon content. Like, for example, stupid sex jokes I have for book titles. How to write fight scenes, because I might have some tips that you might like. And stuff like, oh, what's this? Oh, yeah. So I really want to talk to you about how you're writing kids. That's really interesting. I kind of want to know that. And I want to talk to you about a book that I've been plotting that might need your help. Yeah. All right. But that's all the Patreon stuff. If you always want to check that out, go ahead. But otherwise, I think you have like many other podcasts to listen to on this channel. I think by the time that Aaron's comes out, we are way over 50. So yeah, go ahead.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And check out my books. You probably had parents, even if you're not a parent. We're not weirder than Roombas, so it'll be fine. You'll be fine. If you don't like it, you can stop. That's my promise to you.
I mean, like, here's my comparison, right? So both Roombas and parents clean your room. They're both very handy like that. You're not going to say anything to that. Okay, I can see that. Okay. The trick is, dear kids, to just not clean your room ever. And then at some point, your mom will snap and do it for you. That's a trick. Anyway, thank you, everyone, for listening and watching.
Yeah.
And I'll see you next time. And if you're on Patreon, the show goes on.